Once again, it's time to talk about planets around red dwarf stars. We know that these are under some fairly dangerous conditions at the beginning of their lives, and it's more complicated than you thought. The problem is that when a red dwarf star completes its protostar phase and moves into the main sequence phase, it has a fairly dramatic change in temperature. And so this is like a 1-2 punch. You've got this habitable zone that is pretty far away from the star. Planets that are too close to the star are getting cooked. And then the star cools down, and now the planets that were farther away from the star freeze. The ones that were close already were baked, and so that is not good for life. And then we also know that these red dwarf stars have fairly significant flares for the first few hundreds of millions of years of their life. And so the question is, what does this do to the potential of atmospheres on these worlds? My guest is Dr. Joshua Christensen Totten. He is an assistant professor at the University of Washington. He and his team has worked on a paper talking about how these red dwarf star planets might actually have pretty good chance of holding on to their atmospheres for longer, despite these fairly dangerous conditions around the star. And of course, once the star settles down, it's a red dwarf star and could live for trillions of years. And so that might actually make for a very habitable environment over the long term. Now, we talk about this habitability of red dwarf stars and sort of what is the current state. When will James Webb deliver data about the rest of the planets? And there is no answer. Spoiler alert. But we also talk about Joshua's work with the Habitable Worlds Observatory. And this, of course, is going to be the next observatory that comes after James Webb that is going to do this job of understanding the atmospheres of Earth-sized worlds orbiting around red dwarfs and sun-like stars within the habitable zone. And then finally, we will probably get a definitive answer on these questions. So enjoy this interview with Dr. Joshua Christensen Totten. Josh, we've been hearing a lot that these potential planets around M dwarf stars are in for a rough ride in sort of the early ages of this star. What makes red dwarf stars such a nasty place to grow up near?
Yeah, so there's a lot of potential problems for planets around M dwarf stars. In my mind, probably the biggest problem is the long pre-main sequence of these stars. So this is something that's been talked about a lot in the context of such as the TRAPPIST-1 system. These stars taking potentially hundreds of millions of years to cool off, as it were, onto their main sequence lifetime. And so for that, you know, first few hundred million years, their planets are subjected to extremely high on both bolometric fluxes, so at all wavelengths, the flux from the star is high, and also the high energy XEV radiation is also elevated during this time. And so these planets really get baked for a few hundred million years, potentially driving a lot of atmospheric loss, which, you know, has consequences for their prospects for later habitability.
So we talk a lot about those flares, and I'm sure we're going to get into that in just a second, because because the red dwarfs have a much earlier flare activity. But you're saying just when the star completes its protostar phase and shifts into the main sequence, it is hotter than it will become in its main sequence, and so its habitable zone will need to shift quickly at that point. And so those planets are not going to get too cold, and it was too close that it's now in the habitable zone. It got baked. Like, there's no nice smooth ramp up onto a habitable zone.
Exactly. Yeah. Another way to think about it is during those first few hundred million years, the habitable zone is much further from the star because it's much brighter. And so for planets that will at a later time be in the habitable zone early on, they're receiving a lot of radiation, potentially driving a lot of atmospheric loss. That's one problem. As you kind of alluded to, later in the lifetime, you know, the star is still potentially very active. You have a lot of flaring happening that can sort of add to the cumulative loss. But I guess in my mind, that pre-main sequence phase is perhaps the largest hurdle to habitability.
It's interesting. I had not sort of thought, I wasn't really aware that you got this really rough transition from protostar to main sequence and that it caused such a temperature variation in that direction. I was sort of always assumed it was this slow ramp up in heat. Is that a star like the sun situation, but not, or did even the sun have a similar case at the very beginning?
The sun went through the same sort of process, but it happens much faster for larger mass stars. So the pre-main sequence for the sun was relatively short, 10 million years maybe. I forget the exact numbers, but it means that for planets that formed around the sun, you know, they're not subjected to these really high luminosities for a long time. And so, you know, while there probably was, you know, the planets in the early solar system did receive somewhat higher, you know, XUV fluxes, it was less elevated and for less time. And so it's really only for the M dwarfs that they go through this really violent early evolution.
And so how has our observations of M dwarf planets matched up with the theoretical expectations? Well, like James Webb has already imaged, we've seen the results from the first two planets. I know that it has imaged other, maybe not necessarily Earth-sized worlds. I know it's done some super Earths, found atmospheres. What kinds of results have we found from James Webb so far, comparing reality against the theoretical modeling?
So James Webb has looked at a handful of sort of rocky terrestrial-sized planets, including the inner TRAPPIST-1 planets. And for the most part, so the observations that have been done so far that are fairly robust are the thermal emission observations. And these have tended to show that these hot, rocky planets either don't have atmospheres or have relatively thin atmospheres. And this is, I would say, not particularly surprising in terms of theoretical expectations for atmospheric loss. There's this concept known as the cosmic shoreline, which is kind of a quasi-empirical relationship between the insulation that a planetary body receives and its escape velocity, and you can sort of plot all the different solar system objects on there across many orders of magnitude and get a fairly clear empirical separation between the things that are, you know, big enough and cool enough to have held on to some kind of atmosphere and then all the airless planetary bodies in the solar system. And so, you know, based on that kind of expectation, when we look at a lot of these hot rocks around, you know, smaller M dwarf stars, we perhaps wouldn't expect them to have atmospheres, especially given, you know, the pre-main sequence and the really high XUV fluxes that these planets received. What has been trickier to test against theoretical expectations is the more temperate planets, right? Because they're cooler, they're not emitting a lot of thermal radiation, and so the techniques we use to look for atmospheres or not on the hotter planets cannot be easily applied to these more temperate planets. And so I think for those planets, we don't really know yet, you know, how well our predictions are going to do in terms of, you know, whether they've held onto atmospheres and what their atmospheres might look like.
Right, right. And so, you know, what do we think the early history of these planets would be like?
So rocky planets are going to form hot. This is kind of an inevitable consequence of accretion and the gravitational energy that gets dissipated as you build a big rock. Our expectation is that these things start, you know, at a partially molten or completely molten state. They may have accreted some volatiles from the protoplanetary disk, and then they cool and evolve, driven by, you know, what the star is doing, and just by how fast they can lose their interior heat, and atmospheric escape maybe be happening through this time. And so you've kind of got a lot of competing processes that kind of shape what the planet is going to look like, you know, billions of years later, in terms of, you know, how much atmosphere is lost, how many volatiles do you hold on to. And so it's potentially quite a complex early evolution.
But I mean, we think about the Earth, and we know that, you know, whatever volatiles Earth had at the very beginning, we think was burned off by the radiation from the sun, and then some mechanism was delivering those volatiles later on, be it asteroids, comets, maybe dust grains, who knows, but you've sort of got the, and then Earth was able to hold on to that atmosphere with its gravity and magnetic field.
So this is, the early history of Earth's volatiles is something that's also kind of an active area of research. It's certainly true that you know, any thin hydrogen-rich atmosphere that may have been accreted was very quickly lost. But, to first order, Earth's composition kind of looks like a chondrite. And so it may be that a lot of the volatiles were accreted, you know, as the planet formed, and that you didn't actually need. I'm sure there was some component of volatiles that was added later, but you may not have needed that to kind of explain the Earth's bulk volatile inventory, the carbon, the water, and so on.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah, I know that it's like one of the big, long, outstanding questions, and I think we report on it like almost once a week. Like, where did Earth's water come from, right? So then you have been thinking about this problem, and you think that, in fact, there might be a way that atmospheres can be replenished over time, even in a hostile environment?
Yeah. Well, I think the main argument that we try to make in this recent paper is that there's really a qualitative difference in how volatiles are lost from kind of these hot rocks that have been most of the objects observed to date with JWST and, you know, the habitable zone objects that are the ones that we are really interested in from an astrobiological perspective. And so we've been attempting to model that early evolution of these rocky planets in as general a way as we can. Obviously, you know, there's so much going on. You can't possibly capture every process, but to the extent that we can try and model the combined atmosphere interior evolution of these young planets, I tend to think it's hard for them to be totally desiccated and to lose all their volatiles.
And so what do you think is the mechanism?
So the main difference has to do with essentially the distance from the star and how that affects the species in the atmosphere, and then how that in turn feeds into what is lost to space. So for planets that are close in, at all times in their evolution, any water that is present at the surface of that planet is steam, right? It's just too hot to condense it out on the surface as liquid water or ice. And so you have a very hydrogen-rich upper atmosphere because water is present as steam. And hydrogen being the easiest thing to lose to space, being the lightest element, is very easily lost in the high-energy, you know, radiation environment of these M dwarfs. And then as it is lost, it can drag along a lot of the heavier, you know, carbon, oxygen-bearing species. So that at the end of that process, you're left with something that's pretty desiccated, potentially an airless rock or if not airless, something that's got, you know, such a small surface volatile inventory that you could easily lose it to other processes. In contrast, for things that are in the habitable zone, you know, they go through this pretty violent early evolution. But as the star cools off, eventually the surface cools off such that you can condense out water. So the water condenses out as liquid water or ice. This is just an inevitable consequence of the distance from the star that the planet occupies. And once you condense out that surface liquid water, you have much less, you know, hydrogen-bearing stuff in the upper atmosphere. And so it's much harder to maintain like really high atmospheric loss rates And so the atmosphere subsequently tends to be more robust. And so this is, this isn't new, this difference between escape and hot runaway greenhouse atmospheres versus more temperate planets. But what we've tried to do is put this in the full context of a planet's early evolution, cooling off from a magma ocean, thinking about the chemistry of the atmosphere as it interacts with the magma ocean. And when you put all those things in, you kind of get to the same answer that it's hard to lose all the volatiles on these more temperate planets.
And give me a sense of the time frame, because I'm assuming, because now you've got a very long amount of time that you are in orbit around your star, potentially trillions of years. And the star is, after that initial phase, is no longer putting out the kind of radiation that's going to strip atmosphere away. Do you sort of see this atmosphere just getting thicker and stronger over time?
So that's sort of a complex question on the geochemical cycling between the atmosphere and the interior. And so it depends on what the interior is doing. So in our calculations, we don't sort of explicitly treat that. But I would say we try and be fairly conservative. So you calculate, how much water and carbon is sort of trapped in the mantle as that hot magma ocean freezes. And then subsequently, we just don't allow for any interaction between the interior and the surface. So that's kind of a conservative assumption, because in reality, things are going to get outgassed. You're going to have volcanoes replenishing the atmosphere. But we're saying even when that doesn't happen, you still expect to retain pretty large surface volatile.
Right. So you're just retaining this atmosphere and maybe slight interactions between the atmosphere and the surface layer of what's on the planet. And that alone is getting you this level of atmosphere. But as you say, obviously, you're going to get plate tectonics. Well, hopefully, you're going to get plate tectonics, unless Earth is the only place in the entire universe with plate tectonics, just ask Venus.
But I mean, there are ways that geochemical cycling could work against you as well. If you had a thick CO2 atmosphere and then it all gets weathered out, and you have something thinner that's more easily erodible. So it's not necessarily true that the geochemical cycling is always going to help you maintain an atmosphere. But in general, I think that's the potential for outgassing is going to help.
I had reported on a paper a couple of months ago that people were looking at the amount of volatiles that magma can absorb. And it actually it's quite an impressive sink for various kinds of volatiles, and then can drag it down into the ground. And, that may help explain some of the sort of density measurements of the planet and so on. And in fact, it might be that you're going to get this constant cycle, as you say, of bringing those material up. But I guess what you're saying is that it might be good, it might be bad. You don't know. You can't count on it. Don't depend on it.
I think it's probably good, though. I mean, in general, the processes, the number of ways in which you can draw down volatiles and store them in the mantle forever is more difficult than it is to just degas what's in the mantle.
One of the most interesting ideas for even trying to make Mars more habitable is that if you can just block the solar wind, then the outgassing that's coming from the planet itself would start to thicken the atmosphere. Like it's this ongoing process. If you can stop the erosion, then it'll get thicker, and maybe eventually water will melt on Mars and you can sort of get to a place that's mostly awful, but not completely awful. So I wonder sort of what the long-term implications are. And I don't know, like it sort of starts to move into this almost Gaia sort of theory that, once you've got life there, it's got enough of a head start, then it can start to help manage these cycles on the planet. And you've got trillions of years to figure it out. So, but I understand I'm way off into speculation mode now. so Let's talk about observations then. So, you know, what are you going to be looking for as you examine the various work that's being done with James Webb, observing these M dwarf planets? What are some of the hints that you're going to be looking at to tell you that, okay, maybe you're on the right track?
So it's tricky because for the temperate planets that, you know, the models would suggest are kind of the best candidates for holding on to atmospheres, there are some pretty severe observational challenges. And I think you chatted with Julian a bit about some of these, the problem of stellar contamination for transiting planets means that isolating the signal from the planet's atmosphere and separating it from, you know, the noise that the star is introducing is proven to be more challenging than most people were expecting. With that said, I think we should try because, you know, we don't have really any other opportunities to look at temperate terrestrial planet atmospheres in the near future. And there are observational approaches that could help sort of minimize the effect of that stellar contamination. And so I guess in my mind, even though it is, you know, a difficult and somewhat risky observation to make, I think the potential payoff from, you know, trying to look at these atmospheres is so great that we should try and do that.
But like, assuming that we are able to figure out what is what is being caused by the variations of the star itself, and you're able to really truly isolate these exoplanets, how would you know whether you're looking at some different process or in fact, yes, the planets are holding onto their atmospheres in a way that maybe defied expectation?
So I don't think you would necessarily know straight away, right? You're just getting a data point or a couple of data points on atmospheric outcomes for rocky planets. And it would take some detective work, I think, to take those observations and whatever they're telling you about the atmospheric composition and try and map that to kind of theoretical expectations. I wouldn't necessarily expect, we see an atmosphere, you know, this confirms everything we thought we knew about, you know, planetary evolution. But it would be some data, right? Like we currently have pretty much, other than the solar system planets, we have no data on the atmospheres of temperate rocky exoplanets. And so we have all these interesting ideas and theories on atmospheric evolution that are kind of grounded in comparative planetology of Venus, Earth, and Mars, and the fundamental physics and chemistry that we think govern planetary atmospheres. But it's very much untested. And so I think, you know, any information we can get on these atmospheres, you know, whether they have CO2 or oxygen left over from hydrogen loss, like these would be really valuable tests of understanding of how planets work.
It's a funny time where the, you know, it's a scientific question. It does have an answer. If we had the right instruments, if we had, say, spacecraft that we had sent to every single one of these star systems, we could be taking pictures of them locally. We would have answers to those questions. Webb theoretically can deliver the answer to this question, but I think, you know, the interview that I did that you referenced, it's trickier than I think anyone had expected, or maybe as tricky as everyone had expected, and it turns out it's still tricky, and it's just those of us who are watching from the sidelines are going, come on already, tell us whether or not there's habitable worlds at TRAPPIST-1. But hopefully, sort of, if not this round of instruments to find the answer, the next round of instruments will get us the answer. So, you know, I'd like to shift gears and talk about your work on the Habitable Worlds Observatory.
Yeah, so the Habitable Worlds Observatory is a mission that's being planned. And so this was recommended by this astrophysical decadal survey, which kind of looks at the landscape of astronomy and makes recommendations for what future missions should happen. And so the decadal survey recommended that the next big flagship mission be a space telescope purpose-built to look for signs of life on rocky planets around Sun-like stars, and that it should look for signs of life on around 25 potentially habitable planets. So that was kind of the directive from this decadal survey. And so it's since that directive a few years ago, it's gradually been ramping up, and it's currently in this planning phase. We're thinking about, okay, what would it take to do this, to survey X planets for signs of life? What do we want to make sure the telescope can do in terms of like the wavelength coverage and sensitivity and things like that, with the idea being that this thing would fly sometime in the 2040s. And you might think, that's so far away, like why are you spending time thinking about it now? But the thing is, like, a lot of engineering choices can get locked in fairly early on, because it takes a very long time to, you know, build these missions and test them and make sure it's all working properly. And so we wouldn't want to inadvertently lock in some mission architecture that it later turns out it means we can't actually, you know, do the search for life because it doesn't have the capabilities. So,
yeah. I don't think anybody is surprised that it's going to take that long. I mean, we watched what happened with Webb. What was it? The Next Generation Telescope proposed in 97, mm-hmm. launched 25 years later. Yeah, feels about right.
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to, you know, incorporate the lessons learned from Webb to be very deliberate in the early planning stages to kind of avoid any unexpected surprises in building the instruments. But yeah, whatever happens, it's going to be a long process.
Right. And so, you know, from your perspective and even the work that you're contributing to this telescope, what are you hoping it will be able to do?
Lots of ways I could answer that question. I think in my mind, what you really want to make sure you do is that you build a telescope that's sufficiently capable to tell you something about the distribution of life in the universe, no matter what the kind of universe we live in, right? Like, if we live in a universe full of life, then yeah, you want to have the capabilities to detect that and corroborate it, you know, not just see perhaps, you know, one biosignature, but have enough contextual information to really understand what's happening on that planet and be more definitive in your assessment that it is life and not some non-biological process, you know, mimicking a biosignature. But you also want to learn something if we happen to live in a universe where there's no life, right? So you want to have enough of a sample so that, you know, a null result is meaningful and, you know, perhaps starts to hint that maybe life is quite rare. And so that's kind of been my attitude, that we want something that's generally capable for whatever kind of universe we find ourselves in.
Yeah, I remember interviewing somebody about the original LUVOIR concept, which, you know, I know that someone took LUVOIR and HABEX and just kind of mashed them together into, you know, HWO. But he was saying that, yeah, if you turn that thing on, it's a 15-meter visible light telescope and you're observing exoplanets to such a volume of space that you can then say, okay, we are 95% sure. We have failed to observe any habitable worlds within this sphere. We are 95% sure that there is no other life in the universe, that life is rare or even unique on planets. And it's sort of amazing that that is the kind of, either way, you know, the famous Arthur C. Clarke quote, you know, either we're alone in the universe or not, and either possibility is equally terrifying. What kind, you know, I mean, I think all of the focus and interest is on, let's see another Earth. And that's what the sort of optics of this telescope is going to be geared towards. But do you think that these M-dwarf stars and their planets offer as much hope for life as the sort of more traditional other Earth?
I think that's something we'd like to know going into habitable worlds, right? And I think this is, in my mind at least, a big motivation for really hammering the TRAPPIST-1 system with the James Webb Space Telescope and any other systems that, you know, we might be able to say something about the atmospheres of planets, because, you know, currently we just don't really know. Like, we have the data point that we find ourselves around a G star. Maybe that's meaningful, but it's a sample of one. And we have some theoretical expectations based on, you know, atmospheric loss and that potentially make these, you know, planetary systems a more hostile place for life. But, you know, as we tried to show in our paper, it's not, it's all not all doom and gloom. That, like, we could at least hope for them to hold on to some volatiles. Habitability is a somewhat separate question, but it's of course a prerequisite just to hold on to some volatiles. So, yeah, I think we just don't know. And without some data points, we won't know if kind of the M dwarf sample that habitable worlds is going to look at is potentially astrobiologically interesting, or whether really we're going to be limited to the more sun-like stars in terms of the potentially habitable objects.
Yeah, and I can see how that does define the engineering priorities, because if you know, James Webb starts to bring some hints that there is in fact habitable type worlds around these M dwarfs, if Ariel, you know, from the European Space Agency, which is going to be observing exoplanetary atmospheres, even if, say, the extremely large telescope can pitch in, and you get to this place where you're like, okay, we're seeing hints that these planets are potentially habitable, that defines the engineering requirements of the mission. But if you say, nope, every one of them is clearly airless, then it's looking really bleak for M-Dwarf. Like, we can write off almost the entire, like, maybe there'll be some chance of one showing up way down the road, but in general, we can write these off. But that means that you're now having to do the much more difficult job of building a telescope capable of resolving the brightness of an Earth-sized world orbiting around a sun-like star. That is a, you know, they are a much, what is it, 10 billion to one brightness difference. Like, it's a totally different engineering challenge. And so it'd be good to have that set and known, absolutely, before you go down that road.
You know, it's not a theoretical trade-off, right? Like, the contrast ratio is easier for these lower mass stars. And so there are certain ways in which it is easier to kind of push your telescope design and your sample of planets that you expect to get in the direction of smaller stars. And so if we were going to do that, we would want to be pretty sure that these are actually potentially habitable candidates. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
So, you know, I think a lot of my audience is, you know, one of the most common questions I get is when are we going to know? When are we going to find out? When are we going to hear the results? And, you know, they've been taken, they're sort of currently in embargo. But, you know, even that is probably going to get lifted pretty soon. Like, it's been a while. When do you think we will have a fairly good answer to this question? Like, when do you think people can go either, yes, M dwarfs are the new terrestrial, are the new other Earths, or nope, they all seem to be kind of airless, you know, this year, next year, 10 years from now?
You know, I think it's going to be a while, because, you know, for the most part, I mean, there are a few things in the pipeline that haven't been published yet. But because of this issue of stellar contamination, I don't think we're going to have a really clear answer on, you know, do these temperate planets have atmospheres in the immediate future. And at least in previous JWST, you know, proposal cycles, this issue has been justification for not selecting, you know, additional, not selecting additional observations of these temperate planets, which is, you can understand it, right? If you can't demonstrate that you can subtract out the effect of the star, then it's harder to make the case that we should spend this precious time looking at these planets. So it's hard to be specific, but I suspect it's going to be a few years for observations to be made in a way that can subtract that stellar noise, and then to build up enough observations to definitively detect an atmosphere or suggest that one is absent.
But we're, you know, this is one of the main pillars, one of the main science goals of this telescope, right? Like, observe the early universe, observe newly forming planetary systems, observe the atmospheres of exoplanets, and ideally Earth-sized exoplanets. And so, you know, I think that those first couple of years, those first few rounds, they were a, like, let's hope we catch the low-hanging fruit. But do you think now a, like we're sorry to ask, but we need 1,000 hours on James Webb to make this observation and do it definitively. Are we now shifting into that regime of proposals?
It's hard to say. So something that is happening currently is some director's discretionary time has been awarded to this or dedicated to this question of, like, do rocky planets around the M-dwarfs have atmospheres? So, you know, I don't understand all the details of it, but it's sort of separate from the main proposal process where a decision is made, kind of as you described it. This is a science priority, and we should just dedicate, you know, 500 hours to answering this question. But that is mostly going to be looking at these hot rocky objects again, so thermal emission observations of these hot objects to try and figure out if there's a pattern to which ones have atmospheres and which don't, or indeed if any have atmospheres. So I think that's kind of a step in that direction, but it's not quite the same thing as, you know, spending 1,000 hours on the temperate planets and to see if they have atmospheres. Yeah, I'm not sure what will happen this round if you know, section committees will kind of buy the arguments that we've figured out ways to subtract the stellar noise. I'm hopeful. I think there's sort of a natural conservatism in the process, right? That if you propose something that, you know, yeah, the payoff is potentially high, we're looking at, you know, temperate, rocky planets, but there's some risk that we're going to get nothing, that the noise is, you know, not going to be able to be subtracted, then you could see why a time allocation committee would look at that and compare it to something where there's, you know, definitely going to be some science payoff and say, well, you know, maybe we do this other thing instead until you've figured out a way to definitely do this.
But at a certain point, I think all other choices have been used up. All, like, it just comes down to brute force, raw horsepower. Like, you're going to need a lot of time to get a lot of data that can then, you can pull the signal out of that noise. And it might be that it's, you know, if it's not this year, it's next year. At some point, someone's going to go, if we want the answer to this question, we're going to need to focus this telescope on TRAPPIST-1 for a long time. There was a David Kipping, the Cool Worlds Lab people, they recently got time to do an observation for ExoMoon. And they got like 40 hours of observing time. That's a lot. And they were able to offer some additional things. They're going to be able to measure the oblateness of the planet and a few other things. But I think, you know, clearly there's an interest in, and the public, I know, like, if there's one result that my audience wants to know is, are there habitable, you know, are there atmospheres in the habitable zone around TRAPPIST-1?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could not support you more there. I think from the interest of, you know, from the perspective of public interest, right? This is the question, and one would hope that broader interest would factor into the risk calculus of these decisions to some extent. I mean, in the back of my mind, right, there's always the thought, sure, hopefully this telescope will last for many, many years and we'll be able to collect observations, you know, long beyond its sort of nominal lifetime, but you never have any guarantees of that, and it's not easily serviceable. And so, you know, this is kind of our one opportunity to look at rocky planet atmospheres. I mean, maybe the ground-based ELTs will be able to look at a couple, but there's a lot of uncertainties there. So it may be the only opportunity before Habitable Worlds Observatory to look at potentially habitable rocky planet atmospheres. And so if it was up to me, like every transit, we would be observing and trying right. to make sense of the
yes.
It's not up to me.
No. But I think also, as we mentioned earlier on, that the actual technical decisions made for habitable worlds depends on these observations as well. So at a certain point, it is a ticking clock that needs to be resolved. Well, Joshua, thank you so much for your time. Good luck finding out with the rest of us whether or not there's atmospheres at the TRAPPIST-1 planets. And good luck with your work on habitable worlds.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been really great chatting with you.
Take care. Now, before this interview, I asked my patron community if they had any questions for Joshua, and they delivered. And so we got a bunch of really excellent questions and fairly lengthy answers from Joshua about this. And so that is available on the patron-only feed. Now, you can subscribe to the patron-only feed for free. You don't have to give us any money. You just have to come to patreon.com/universetoday and you can sign up and you can get those additional answers. And we'll put a link here and in the show notes. You can get that additional content. Now, I'm going to give you some additional resources so you can continue on in this journey. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Bear Lake Roofing, David Giltinan, David Matz, Dennis Lilbury, Dustin Cable, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Rohrbach, scienceworldrecord.org, spiderswap.io, Stephen Krasaki, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our other supporters on Patreon. This is just one interview that I've done about the capability of James Webb to observe planets around red dwarf stars, and so I'm going to provide you with several links to other interviews that I've done. One is really about what are the results of James Webb so far. When will we finally get an answer on the TRAPPIST-1 worlds? And the other video is the interview that we mentioned in this interview, talking about how red dwarf stars can pollute and contaminate the observations made by telescopes like James Webb. And so it's actually a very difficult observation to make. And it's been surprising that this is as much of a problem as it is, and that future space telescopes will have to sort of deal with the variability in the brightness, the impact that the star has on the observations of the planet. So, you know, we have done tons of interviews about the subject. And so if you want to continue going down this rabbit hole, there's plenty of directions that you can take from here on.